Hey guys, we are back with another episode of the Strand Forward podcast. Today's guest, I'm very excited to have on. He has got one heck of a story to share with you guys. So he just hiked the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine successfully. And I want to highlight that successfully because a lot of people start it and they quit it, or they just do half of it, or they do a section of it or whatever. He did the whole thing. He did it by himself. But he had help along the way, but we're gonna get into that. It is such a cool story. I'm excited selfishly just to hear the details about it because I've always wanted to do this. I'm excited for you guys to just glean some wisdom from him about the experience and all of the ups and downs, no pun intended, through the mountains. So this is gonna be really cool. His name's Hudson Brock. So Mr. Hudson, why don't you give us a quick intro into who you are, how old you are, what you do for a living.
Oh, yeah.
And let's do this thing.
So, hey, y'all. I'm Hudson. So, I just graduated. I'm 24, and I just graduated in December of 23. And so, for the past few years, I knew that I kind of wanted to do the entire Appalachian Trail. And I figured the best time to do it would be shortly after college. So, I did college in 4.5 years, slowed down a little bit because of COVID, but that lines up really well with hiking the AT because a lot of people like to start hiking it in March, April, or very early May because that gives you enough time before fall and winter sets in the north. So, I guess I should say, like, why I decided to do the Appalachian Trail.
Yeah, let's dive right into it.
So my dad and I, we've been doing hiking trips since I was like 8 years old. So he really got me into backpacking at the start. Now these trips are like normal trips where it's like 2, 3, maybe 4 days out in the woods. We would carry everything with us, tents, sleeping pads, etc., food. And so he got me into it. And when we moved to Georgia, obviously a lot of the hikes we did was either like on the AT in Georgia or like connecting to it. So I've been aware that people do the entire AT since I was like little. Because if you ever are out there in April or May, you're almost bound to run into at least someone who's trying to do the whole thing.
Yeah.
And so eventually when COVID hit, I started doing backpacking a lot more because it was only the only like, thing that like wasn't shut down, you know, you could still go out into the woods. And so I met people who just finished college who were doing the whole thing, and they put it into my head that, you know, that's why that I should do that. So fast forward a couple years later, I'm about to graduate, and I'm like, okay, March of 2024, let's do this.
Let's go.
Yeah. And so, like, it was daunting, but, like, you know, I almost had, like, I was so, like, focused on, like, graduating from college, I wasn't even, like, thinking about the AT quite yet. Like, you know, I was, like, prepping in the background, but, like, I had something to take my focus. And then after I graduated, you know, I started prepping for it, and, like, it didn't really hit me that I was about to be in the woods for 5 months until, like, the day before I left.
That's crazy, dude.
I know. It's like...
So, yeah, I want to... So, yeah, let's go right to that. We'll backtrack and go through a bunch of stuff. But, like, walk people through that moment, dude. Like, you're at the start of the trail. You just got there, and you're like, all right, bye, guys.
Yeah.
Here we go. Like, what was that like?
It was pretty crazy. It's not as, like, with a lot of people, they have to, like, travel from all parts of the states or, like, across the world even to, like, get there. But for me, the start of the trail only is, like, 50 minutes from my house. So it's not like you're thinking, so it's not like mentally you're not thinking, like, oh, I have to take a long journey because you just drove 50 minutes from your house.
Mm-hmm.
But then you realize, like, no, you have a backpack on with everything that you're going to be carrying and you're about to walk 2,200 miles from Georgia all the way to Maine. And, like, at first you're like, man, I'm really doing this. And then you go up that first hill. I did what's called the Approach Trail. So the Appalachian Trail, it starts and ends on top of mountains. So there's no, like, road access at the top of the mountain. So you actually have to, like, hike different trails to get to the start and end of it.
Okay.
So in Georgia, that's at Springer Mountain, the southern terminus of the Appalachian Trail. And so I took the Approach Trail, which starts at Amicalo Falls and then hikes 8.8 miles to Springer Mountain. So that was my first day, pretty much, where I just hiked all the way to Springer and then a few more miles to the second shelter, Stover Creek Shelter, on the AT. And, like, I remember thinking at the end of that day, when all you've done is hike 11 miles out of 2,200, like, man, this is going to be daunting.
Yeah. So wait, hold on. I want to make sure I understand correctly. So you had to hike a trail to the start of the AT?
Yes.
So those miles you hiked didn't even really count toward, like, moving you forward on getting done with the trail.
I know. Yeah. It doesn't even count, really.
So you get there, you're already, like, tired, you're drinking your water, and you're like, I guess I'll start.
Uh-huh. Like,
that's crazy.
To put into context, I weighed about 230 pounds March of this year before starting, and across the 4.5 months I hiked it, I lost 40 pounds. So I wasn't, like, in super fit shape beforehand.
Right.
So, like,
that's a pretty good, that's like a normal weight loss journey, though.
Mm-hmm.
So you said it was 5 months. So you lost 40 pounds over 5 months?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not terrible. I mean, that's, like, usually when someone goes into, like, a weight loss journey, you want to lose, you know, 2 pounds a week, something like that, something very sustainable. That's interesting. I would have thought you had said it, like, not that you would have said more, but I guess I thought it would be just more dramatic than that. So were you still eating a good bit of food along the way?
Oh, yeah.
Like, were you consuming a lot of calories?
Oh, yeah. I think my calculation, like, towards the end was something like 4,000 to 5,000 calories a day.
Holy smokes. Okay, yeah. So you were crushing some food.
Mm-hmm. And, like, you have to keep in mind that, like, you have to carry that with you. There's no... I mean,
that was my next question.
There are grocery stores and stuff, but that's only, like, every 5 days on average, you know? So, like, the rest of the time, you have to pack 5 days worth of food, and it's tough.
On top of, you know, your normal camping gear, like, whatever else, which I actually kind of want to go into as well. So, but to stay on the food thing, so what kind of foods were you eating?
So, towards the start, it was a lot more, like, trail mix, a little bit of candy. I had a few freeze-dried meals. And then you need to, like, because you have to keep in mind you're hiking in kind of miserable conditions. I mean, not miserable all the time, but, like, you want to have food that you want to eat because your appetite goes way down after hiking day in and day out because you're just so tired. Your body doesn't think to eat. So you want stuff like Twizzlers or Snickers, something that you really enjoy. I also love peanut butter. At the start, I had, like, these, like, to-go packets or whatever, but by the end, I had, like, the big jars, and I would carry, like, the big jars of Jif peanut butter or Peter Pan, and I would go through it.
Yeah. And you're just eating it by the spoonful as you're walking?
Oh, yeah. I also had these, like, quesadilla wraps with Nutella and peanut butter in it. Those were great. And then the main focus is just, like, getting protein, because that's, like, the one thing that will, like, screw you out there is if you're not getting enough protein intake. So you'll notice, like, a lot of the foods I had, like Snickers, peanut butter, not canned tuna, but, like, the Starkist packages or whatever. All of them are, like, high in protein, because that's just important out there. And then electrolytes, they're super important too. So I have these things called noon tablets. They just dissolve in water. That's super important because that has like several vitamins you may be lacking in, and like electrolytes too, because you're sweating so much, you're losing it while moving.
So how did you carry that much water? Like, how much water were you carrying on you?
So at the beginning, in Georgia, I carried 2.8 liters. So I'd have like two smart water bottles that were 1 liter each. And I would have a filter. They're called Sawyer filters. And essentially, they'll purify water, get rid of any like little floaties, they call them, like leaves or whatever, but also like bacteria and whatever. And so you just attach it to the top of a water bottle and then squeeze it into like a clean bottle. So you like have a bottle for dirty and then another bottle for clean.
Gotcha. And so where would you, so you'd get the water from, just like a creek or something when you'd go by it?
Yeah, the springs, a lot of springs on trail. Because like at least in Georgia through like Virginia, you know, it's a very wet environment. It's considered a temperate rainforest. So it's not like a tropical rainforest where like stuff can grow all year long. But it is, it gets so much water, it is considered a rainforest. Up north, it definitely is drier. So I had to up the amount of water I was carrying to like 3.8 liters. That way I could carry enough so I can refill it all when I could.
Yeah. And carrying that much water, did it feel daunting? Like, did that feel heavy on you when you were carrying it?
Like, besides, like, a full food resupply, the water would be the heaviest thing I was carrying, because it's like 2.2 pounds every liter, I think. So like if you're carrying 4 pounds of water, you know, that's like almost 8, 9, 10 pounds, whatever the math is there. So it's fairly heavy. That would represent like a third of my pack weight. You know, at some points when I had full food, it was less.
Yeah, how much did your pack weigh when everything was full? So you got full food, full water, camping gear. How much did it weigh?
So on day one, it was 44 pounds. By the end of it, it was closer to 34 pounds with full food, full water, that sort of stuff.
Okay, did you just eliminate stuff that you didn't need anymore?
Like when you're hiking day in and day out, you start realizing the things that you're not using and what you don't need. Additionally, I started March 3rd. So, like, the weather is still pretty cold for month and a half. So, you have to carry winter gear. And winter gear is heavier. Because, you know, thicker sleeping pad. You're carrying an extra jacket. That sort of thing. So, I went back in. So kept sending stuff home, ditching stuff, and I was able to eliminate almost 10 pounds from my full weight. And then as I would go through food, that would usually drop to almost 24 pounds.
Okay. That's still really heavy, though. Like, people, because I'm just thinking, like, you know, carrying 40 pounds, like, I've done ruck runs before where you got a ruck with 30 pounds or even, like, 60 pounds. And, like, it's bad, but like carrying something like that for that long.
Oh yeah.
That's where it's like, okay, this really takes a toll. Like the exponential, like the compounding effect on your body, every single step over and over and over with that extra weight. It's like, dude, that gets hard.
Oh yeah.
Go ahead. Say something. Or what were you going to say?
So like, you know, at the very beginning, so, like, the first few weeks, it was just, like, miserable, you know? Like, you already take breaks, and, like, you know, I'm only hiking about 10, 11 miles at the very beginning for the first few days. And, like, you're not used to the pack. Like, you can train, you know, but unless you're training by, like, just going on long-duration camping trips, it's not the same thing. So, like, beforehand, I was doing a little bit of weight, walking as much as I could, like, at a local park where, you know, it was actually rough terrain, not just, like, concrete. But that just doesn't prepare you for, you know, being out there all day. And then, like, the super steep inclines and declines you have when on mountain trails.
Dude. Oh, I'm just imagining you, like, just grinding, huffing and puffing up them hills, dude, just dying.
Oh, yeah.
So another thing about the pack, like, whenever you carry, like, a ruck, at least in my experience, it gets really daunting on your traps, because it's like, if you're just carrying that weight. Did you have, like, a special design where, like, it took the weight off your traps and kind of put it on your low back?
Yeah.
Is it, like, a special design pack?
So most packs have, so if you remember, like, old school backpacks have that, like, metal frame on the outside of it. Now, like, newer packs have what's called, like, a inside frame. So essentially, it's, like, a frame that will adjust where the weight is loaded. So it'll put more of it on your back and hips. That way, you're not just carrying it all on your shoulders and traps.
I was gonna say, dude, because that gets really annoying. Really hard.
Oh, yeah. So, like, after I finished, you know, I wanted to stay in shape and stuff, I got a 40-pound weight vest, and it all gets put on the traps. And, like, you know, my traps definitely developed a lot, but, like, carrying 40 pounds just on your traps feels a lot different than carrying 40 pounds on, like, a efficient backpack.
Yeah, for sure, 100%. So, let's go through your packing list. Like, what all was inside your bag?
So, you have, like, the big three. So, I have, like, the Osprey backpack. I mean, that's a super important thing. If I knew what I know now, I would have gone with, like, a different, like, a smaller pack. Because, like, when you think about, like, every additional little bit of material adds up. So, like, hip pockets you don't need, but they add weight. So I would have gone maybe with, like, a ULA backpack, something like that. That's a little bit lighter, maybe a little bit smaller. And then for a tent, I had a, what's called a Gossamer Gear, the one. Essentially, I have these trekking poles, you know, just like the hiking poles that backpackers use. And so the tent is just like cloth, and then you use the two trekking poles to, like, stand them up.
Yeah.
So, you know, with, like, a teepee style tent, I guess, like, you know, where it has, like, a stake in the middle or the sides. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So that helps because I use the trekking poles to, like, move around all day, and then I can use them to set up my tent, so it saves weight.
Yeah, that's great.
Mm. So
you would just, like, stake those in the ground or something, and then just, like, drape the tarp over, like, a kind of just use that as, like, the columns on either side or whatever?
Yes. So it'd be one trekking pole on each side of me, and then you would have to, like, the flap would open on, like, one half of it, so you kind of have to, like, move around the stake as you get in. And then there's, like, additional metal stakes that you put into, you know, right, the circus tent or whatever.
Right, yeah.
And so that worked pretty well. They're not as, like, stable as, you know, like the metal rods ones where they fold up and collapse and then you have to, like, expand them out. They're not as, like, durable to wind and stuff. You have to really set them up correct. But, like, they're a lot lighter. And, like, you appreciate that. And they're faster to snap, in my opinion.
And would all that stuff fold up pretty condensely, like pretty small?
Oh, yeah. It's just like, you know, the tent itself would just be cloth and stuff, so it just stuffs in a stuff sack. It was only, like, this big when stuffed together. Made it a lot easier. And then, as, like, an additional note, like, it's just a single layer tent, so it's lighter. And it's rainproof, but the downside of, like, single layer versus dual layer is that you get condensation on the inside. It's like as water is moving through the air, it gets stuck on the inside of your tent. So there were a few times where I didn't set up my tent in a good area, And so the clouds were able to go through the fog. And so I'd wake up to a tent that was wet on the inside on a dry night.
Yeah, that's miserable, dude. Waking up like that and everything's just like, oh, it's so I hate that feeling.
It only happened like a few times, so it wasn't too bad. But like, that's definitely the risk you take when you're just doing a single layer tent.
And so you said it only happened a few times. So what was, like, how did you prevent that from happening other times? Like you said, like, where you set up mattered?
Yeah, where you set up, like, you're trying to avoid being right next to, like, a creek or river because, like, that can add humidity to the air. If you set up your tent, like, in a lower-lying area, so, like, if you're on top of a mountain, way more likely that low-lying clouds are going to move on the top of that mountain. And clouds are just, like, water in the air, you know? So that means, like, condensation will get in your tent. I seem to have a good eye for choosing locations. And, like, less wind helps, too. So just in general, you want to choose a good tent site, because a good tent site means, like, you're going to have a better night's rest.
Yeah. Okay, I got you. So now, okay, so keep going. So what else was in your pack? So we covered the tent. What else was in there?
So I had a 20-degree sleeping bag. Essentially, it was a synthetic one, too. There's, like, down sleeping bags that are, like, bird feathers and stuff. They're lighter. The synthetic pack, it was a 20-degree bag, but a lot of the reviews say it feels more like a 15-degree bag, and I would agree with that. Because you just need it to be a 15-degree, meaning, like, temperature. That's the temperature rating on it.
Yeah.
And so, brought that with me because it gets super cold, you know, it gets below freezing a lot early on.
Dude.
And, yeah, I used that. Sometimes I would sleep with, like, just my sleeping bag. Sometimes I had to put on my jackets and stuff because it got super cold.
Dang.
Yeah. And then I had a down jacket, so just like one of those, North Face, like, synthetic jackets or whatever they're called. I had like a mid-layer fleece from Patagonia. I kept a long sleeve Patagonia t-shirt, just like their athletic shirt. I chose a long sleeve because early on, like, it's nice to have a long sleeve in the cold, but also, like, you can get a lot of sun on you at points, and so that has, like, a big SPF rating, the shirt does, so, like, it prevents, like, the sun from just burning my arms real easily.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, so what else did you have in there?
So I had a little, like, propane tank, and then, like, a little, like, foldable stove for cooking meals. Cool. Utensil. I just had, like, a long spoon that I could, like, dig into the bowls and stuff. People always get surprised by this, but, like, the only knife I had on me was a Swiss Army knife. Because, like, a big knife costs weight. Like, you don't think about this, but, like, every little additional thing you take with you adds up.
So why do people get surprised by that? They think you'd want some sort of bigger weapon?
Yeah, they think, like, going out in the outdoors, you're going to be bringing, like, a big hatchet with you, and you're going to be chopping stuff all the time, when you realize, like, no, you don't want to waste the effort on chopping stuff, you just go around it. And so, I had, like, a small little first aid kit, nothing, like, super fancy in it, just, like, the essentials, like Benadryl, athletics tape, that's huge for like blisters or whatever. Some like, you know, like antibacterial stuff, you know, just where it only weighed a few ounces and I'm not taking anything I don't need. I took a wilderness first aid class before I left, you know, just so I could feel like I knew what to do in case of emergency, and that really helped.
Yeah,
honed what I needed.
Well, I was gonna say, I feel like that's probably a really smart thing to have in case you you slip and cut your leg, or you're working with a knife and you cut your finger or something like that. Like, you're not trying to get an infection.
Right. Besides that, I had rope for a bear hang. So, there's black bears out there, and you're legally required to store your food in a bear-safe manner. So there's pretty much two methods to it. You can either do a bear hang, where you take a rope, you throw it over a branch in a high tree, and then you raise up your food so it's out of the way of the bear. Or you can haul a bear can with you, which is this big, thick plastic container where bears can't, dig into it. But the bear can weighs heavier than just rope.
I was going to say, yeah. rope wins on that one, for sure.
Yeah. It just takes longer to set up. Because the bear can, you just have to set out a bit away from your camp. But with bear rope, you have to, find a good spot, throw your rope over it. So it can take longer, to say the least. Yeah. By the end, usually I could do it in, 5 minutes or less. But, early on, it definitely took, 10, 15 minutes to find a good branch and, hang it.
Yeah. After a while, you just started identifying the branches quicker. Like, okay, that one will work. Mm-hmm. Now this is the process.
Yeah, plus, on the way into camp, when you know you're, close to it, you can start looking for, a good place to hang your stuff. That way you're not, having to backtrack.
Yeah, that makes sense. How long would it take you to set up camp? Your whole camp, tent, everything.
I think early on I gave myself, an hour or so. Just because, it includes everything, changing, getting everything out, setting up your tent, bear hang, all that. I include, getting water and stuff in that, too. Later on, you could do it rather fast, because, you've set up the tent 100 times, you've hung up bear rope 100 times, so it's not you're used to it, so you just get faster at it.
Did you ever get, I don't know how to ask this question. Comfortable is not the word, because I'm sure you got comfortable out there, or kind of got into, a routine. But did you ever start to feel I'd be okay not going back to civilization?
Yes and no. Because, you have high days, you have low days. And, on high days, when I'm in the Whites or I'm in the Smokies, where it's just so beautiful out there. And, all you think about is hiking with your friends that you've met out there. You're like, yeah, I never want to go back. And then you have days where it's raining. It's in the 50s. You're just like, man, why am I out here? Why am I doing this? And you kind of... Someone put this better that I was on trail with. His name was... his trail name was Taxi. But he said, being out in the woods and going through all the miserable stuff out there makes you appreciate civilization a lot more. You go to...
comfort.
Yeah. Beforehand. And this is not, dissing on Motel 8. But, Motel 8 is not the highest, five-star hotel. And, before doing the trail, you don't, appreciate everything they give you. But, on the trail, you stay at Motel 8, and you're like, this is luxury. You're just...
a five-star resort.
Uh-huh. They give you, a free chocolate muffin. They have showers and stuff with hot water. And it's just man, this is amazing. A bed that, you didn't have to look for rocks underneath your tent beforehand.
Wow. Yeah, so you're finally I can just lay in this bed and just sleep.
Yeah.
How good did you sleep when you were out there? Did you get to the point where you could sleep pretty good?
Oh, yeah. You're just exhausted on a lot of days, and so your body finds a way to sleep.
I was going to say, yeah. Because I've gone camping before and stuff, and you never, at least for me, I've never slept that great. It's just you're uncomfortable, or you're, maybe you're kind of scared because you're like, I don't know, there are bears out here, whatever. You're just like, you're just not sleeping that great because you don't do it that often. But like, did you get to the point where you're like, those thoughts didn't even enter your mind? You're just like, I don't care what's out here, what's around me, I'm sleeping.
There's definitely a few days where like, I just got so tired that I was just like, I'm laying down and I'm going to bed. Like, after this, I want to like walk through the start of the trail to this point. But when I was in New Jersey, I was in New Jersey and I hiked 28 miles that day. It was my longest hiking day and I was just exhausted by the end. Cause like a few things had happened where I wasn't able to set up camp like earlier cause, there just wasn't a good place to camp. So I kept going and going and going. There's a place that sold ice cream that was in New York when I crossed into that state. And, you know, I just, like, devoured a milkshake from there and then hiked another mile to the shelter. There's a few people. The sun had already set. I literally, like, there was a bear locker there, like a big metal container. They have them in some of the campsites and shelters. I put my food in there. Took out, like, my sleeping pad, put it down, and I, like, went to bed immediately. Didn't even, like, do everything I needed to.
Yeah, you were just exhausted.
Yeah. But dang. I slept really good that night.
I bet, dude.
Yeah.
So how often did you see people out there on the trail?
So, I guess I'm going to answer that in the way that, like, how I saw people at the very start. So usually, like, if you start hiking, at least in the South in March, like, you don't usually see a lot of people out there. But since you're on the AT, they say there's about 3,000 to 4,000 people who do the Appalachian Trail each year. So the day I arrived, March 3rd, there was a decent amount of people starting already. So the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, the ATC, they're like the nonprofit group that like tracks a lot of this stuff. They work with the trail clubs, like keep kind of rough track how many people are doing it each year. So at Amicalola, they give out these hiker tags that like is your number for that year. So I was northbound hiker number 661. So that means from January 1st to March 3rd, there were 660 people who had already started.
Wow, that's a lot, actually.
Yeah, by 2 weeks later, that number was, like, at 1,500. So, like, you know, a lot more people heading out every day. So the first shelter I stayed at, Stover Creek, there was over a dozen people camping there. Then there's another shelter just like 2 miles back. And I bet that one also had a dozen people at least. Then there's another shelter a few miles ahead. And I bet that one also had a few dozen people. And like all those people or most everyone at those shelters are planning to hike the entire Appalachian Trail. And so like you have a lot of camaraderie at the very beginning because like you just have there's a ton of people, you're all facing the same challenges, you're like, oh, that approach trail sucked, didn't it? And it's like everyone's like agreeing, clamoring, and I feel like by day three that's when the reality starts to hit people of like, oh, this is what's going on, this wasn't just some walk. There's a book called A Walk in the Woods. But, like, I think some people go out there, they don't realize quite what it means.
Yeah, they have no idea.
Yeah, and, like, I bet you... Oh, yeah, and so, like, of everyone who starts the trail, they say somewhere between 20 to 30% of people finish.
Yeah, I figured it'd be something like that.
Yeah. So it's crazy. Yeah. Like,
quit.
Because I even like joked about that on night one with a guy named Tigger. To put it into context, hikers, there's like this hiking culture thing where you all have, like, trail names that, like, either relates to something you did on trail or something like that. So I'll refer to, like, weird names like Tigger, Taxi, all that sort of stuff. But I met a guy...
What was yours?
Oh, it was Huddle. So to give the short of it, my dad and I, when we go backpacking, we always go to, like, a breakfast place after we finish. Because you're hungry, you want food, that sort of stuff. So in the Southeast, there's a place called Huddle House. Kind of like a Waffle House.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was the closest location, so we go there after, like, a three-day trip. I was around 11 at the time, so, like, 11-year-old boy, like, really wants food. And so you get in there, you're trying to hydrate, so you're getting water, drinking. You get the American breakfast that's, like, two eggs, sausage, hash browns, like, big waffle. You're drinking, your food comes, you start eating. I usually work on, like, the egg, sausage, all that, and save the waffle for last. And, like, most of the way through the meal, eventually I have to use the restroom. Because I just drank, like, 3 cups of water or whatever. So we both get up, leave the table, and go to the restroom. I had half a waffle left. And when I get back, they had cleared the table. Yeah. So to, like, an 11-year-old boy who just got back from a hiking trip, most devastating thing you can do.
Yeah.
My dad and I went on another trip when I was, like, 18 or 19. And, like, there was a Huddle House. The closest location was a Huddle House. And I was like, oh, no, we're not going there. Last time I went, they stole my waffle. And so that's how I got the name Huddle. And plus, my name, Hudson, gets shortened to Hud sometimes, and Huddle can also get shortened to Hud, so it kind of makes thematic sense.
Yeah, that's actually a perfect combination that works.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what were you saying about the other guy?
So I was joking with a guy named Tigger. He was at the first shelter, and I was like, you know, everyone at the shelter, you know, only like, of the 12 people at the shelter, you know, only, like, 3 of us are going to make it to the end, if that. And the wildest thing was, as far as I can remember, it was only Tigger and I from that campsite that actually finished.
No way, really?
Yeah. But it's, like, one of the things you have to realize is that people drop out early fast. So the ATC, they've done studies on this, and they figured that by the time, if you can make it to the Smoky Mountains, so the Smoky Mountains are at like the 10% mark, so you've done 1/10 of the trail. If you can make it to the Smoky Mountains, like your chance of completing the trail jumps up to like 80%.
Really?
Yes. I mean, I don't know if that's exact, but like, I know at least like, 50 to 60% of the people who quit before the Smokies.
Yeah.
And then,
why do you think that is? No, go ahead. Actually, finish your thought, but then I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Like, it's experience. A lot of people, you know, you go out there and like, on average, like the most someone's hiked is like 50 miles in one trip.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the Smokies are like, are around like mile 220, and you're starting early. It's cold, and so you get a mix of rain, sleet, and snow. And so I bet you get a lot of people who quit by that first rain. I remember like some of my most miserable days was when, like you're out of shape, you're sore from the hike you did yesterday. Now you have to hike today, and it starts raining. So in Georgia. I was just hiking along. It's muddy in one section. At one point, I slipped and, like, had mud covering up my legs up to, like, my hip. It never stopped raining that day. And then because everyone's, like, cold and miserable, people stay at the shelter so they can get secured. So we're packed in this, like, what's supposed to be a 6-person shelter with, like, 8 people in it, and we're packed in, like, sardines.
Yeah. So did you ever have days where you, genuinely felt like quitting? You were like,
yeah,
I'm good if I don't do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I was told or heard from people, like, you never want to quit on a bad day, because if you quit on a bad day, the trip is just bad at the end. So, like, what the general advice is that if you're having a rough time, go into town, get a hotel or a hostel or something, have a nice bed, and see if you feel better in a day or two. And generally speaking, whenever I felt bad and miserable and I did something like that, I felt a lot better the next day. You know, you realize, like, you know, but the thing, pain is temporary. For every day that was bad, there's another day that was great. You just have to get through the bad days, and eventually, like, as you get more in shape, as you make more miles, as you realize, like, you're doing more and more of the trail, like, more days will feel great.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it is part of the adventure too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd love for it to be, blue skies, sunny weather, 75 degrees, and it just it's amazing. Scenery is incredible the whole time. Like, of course, we would all want that, but. You know, when you get done and you look back and you're like, man, there was this one time where this storm came through and I was all like soaking wet. Like, you tell the story and then you're like, dang, I guess it kind of was fun. Like, it sucked and I wanted to quit, but it made it really adventurous.
And I'd say it was absolutely worth it. You know, like, so the trail, it goes through 14 states. So, like, it goes from, like, Georgia to North Carolina to Tennessee. And so hiking through, like, just the little, like, rush of endorphins of, like, being like, I finished the Georgia section, now I'm on to North Carolina. I finished the North Carolina section, now I just need to complete Tennessee. And as you keep doing that, that, like, gives you, like, a big rush. You also, the great thing about being out there is that there's, you know, you meet people. You get this, like, they joke about it, but, like, it's called a trail family of, like, all the friends you meet along the way. And, like, you have a group of people that you can just talk about what the trail's like. You can say, man, that section sucked. And it gives you that, like, momentum boost. The people around you, like, drive you to go further the next day. They amp you up. It's like that guy Tigger, I hiked with him for, like, almost 1,000 miles, kept running into each other. We went to, like, a ton of campsites and stuff. And, like, you don't think about that. You don't think about, like on night one that I was going to be with that guy for so long. And yeah. I still, like, text him. We exchange stuff still. And so I met so many great people from, like, all corners of the world. You know, it's mostly, like, Americans who are hiking it, but I also met people from, like, the UK, Italy. I met a guy from Japan. And, like, you know, just so awesome hearing about, like, different people's experiences.
It's cool. Yeah, would you guys have some, like, pretty good conversations just about life? Talk and just whatever.
And, like, you get a lot of people in different phases in life. I think the average age on the trail, like, you get a lot of people post high school, post college, and then, like, people 30s and 40s are usually, like, going through, like, midlife crisis, or, like, they got fired from work unexpectedly and they have the money to do it. And then you get a lot of people who are, like, retired from teaching, retired from their jobs, and are hiking the trail now. So you get, like, a huge age range of people out there.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm getting envious listening to you. It sounds like so much fun. So what was, I think people would like to hear this. Give us a high that you had on the trip. Like, what's one moment you can think back where it was, like, a really sweet moment, a really beautiful scenery, whatever. Just a really good moment that sticks out. And then let's do the opposite. Let's talk about, like, one that was... Actually, let's do the bad one first, and we'll end on a good note. So let's go on something that you remember really, really challenging, really hard, you didn't like. It's just, like, a bad memory that sticks out from that trip.
So one of the things that you have to keep in mind on the trail is not getting sick. So there's this thing called norovirus. It gets spread by, like, contact and stuff from, like, contaminants, that sort of thing. Like, human waste, pretty much. I got that in Virginia. And norovirus, you know, out through the mouth, out through the other end. And so it knocked me out for 4 days. I had to, like, get a shuttle off trail to Waynesboro, Virginia, and just pretty much stay in a hotel room for 4 days, stay close to the toilet, you know? That was definitely my low, getting that sick.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, it was just miserable, you know, just being so sick, thinking, man, I'm not able to get back on trail until this is over with. And it was just not fun.
How did you get it, though? So what happened to get it?
So I'm fairly certain I know where I got it. So I was entering to Shenandoah National Park. Great park, by the way. And right before you enter into it on trail, there's this row of porta potties. So I used it, and I used, like, hand sanitizer, but, like, with norovirus, you have to, like, wash your hands with soap and water, and I didn't do that, even though I had soap with me. And so I didn't do that, and I got sick about 24 hours later, which they say is, like, how long it takes from when you contacted it. And so, yeah, I just wasn't being careful. They tell you, they put up signs of warning at every so often, because, like, sometimes there's, like, big outbreaks of norovirus, to, like, wash your hands. Hand sanitizer doesn't work. Absolutely. So I just wasn't careful. I got too comfortable. Because by that point,
right.
I hiked 900 miles or so. I forget the exact mile marker. But that humbled me, to say the least.
Dang, yeah. Oh, any type of sickness like that, it's just so miserable.
And I'd almost say the worst day was the day I started hiking again. Because not only have you not been in the cycle of it for 4 days, but you're also recovering from sickness. So, like, I knew that my prior pace, I should have been moving a lot faster than I did. By that time, I was doing, like, 20-mile days. At least, you know, 22 usually. And so getting back on trail, I only did like 13, 14 miles on the trail in Shenandoah. And Shenandoah is known for being like a super comfortable trail to hike on that you can like hike pretty fast on. And that was frustrating.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, plus, you probably weren't eating a whole lot either during those 4 days.
Oh, no. Like, appetite goes through the floor. Like, I have to force myself to eat.
And then you try to come back and go hiking and your energy's low. You just probably takes a bit to recover from that.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So let's go to the opposite end. So tell us about a really great memory you have from the trip.
Oh yeah.
Anything.
So I'm gonna give it a little bit of context. So, hiking in the Southeast, you know, it's the green tunnel. Like there's trees everywhere. And so, like, you never get above what's called tree line. So essentially, like, as it gets colder and as you get higher altitude, it stays colder. So that means, like, trees can't grow if you get high up enough. So, like, in the Southeast, it's so warm down here that, like, trees can grow on the tall of the mountains. But as you keep hiking Northeast, it gets cooler and cooler as you get in high elevation. So I entered into New Hampshire. I've hiked 1,500 miles by this point. And New Hampshire has this mountain range called the Whites. Beautiful mountain range because they're all like 5,000 feet plus mountains. And that by that point, you're so far up north. Tree line is at 4,400 feet approximately. So that means like once you get above 4,400 feet, there's no trees, and you can see out for miles around. And so the weather up there can be brutal. But I was hiking the Presidential's Range. It's like a whole series of mountains named after U.S. presidents. like a 14-mile mountain range, you go after peak after peak. So it was very cloudy. So like I was just in the clouds from Washington down to Madison Spring. And I was hiking up Madison, and the clouds disappeared, and you could see the whole mountain range behind you. You could see where the trees stopped growing, and all the green grasses and stuff growing near the tops of mountains. And it was just amazingly beautiful. And, like, it was just, like, one second you're hiking in a fog so thick you can't even see, like, 20 feet ahead of you, to, like, absolute beauty where you can see for miles around. And it was just amazing. Like,
that's so
it's really hard to describe how beautiful it was.
Oh man, it sounds incredible. I'm jealous. Yeah, there's something about, there's a plane going overhead right now.
Well, fine.
It's the beauty of shooting outside.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, dude, that's, just listening to you describe that, man, like, there's like a sense of peace that, like, at least when I was listening to you describe it, I'm just like, oh man, that just feels really good. Just to picture that in my mind and just imagine the mountaintops and the beauty of it. It sounds incredible.
Mm.
Dang. Was there a sense of, when you got to the end, tell me what that experience was like when you got to the end, because I have this idea in my head of what it was like, but I want to hear from you.
So,
like, what did you?
So to put into context of what the end is like, so you're finishing in Maine, and Maine is very sparsely populated. So you have what's called the 100-mile wilderness at the very end. So it's where pretty much there's no towns around. You're literally hiking 100 miles where there's like the occasional logging access road, but you're not going through towns. You have to carry enough food to get all the way through it. For a thru hiker, it's not too bad, because, like, you're doing 20-mile days, so, like, that's just your normal food carry 5 days. But, like, you don't see too many people. It's very boggy. And then the last mountain that's right after the 100-mile wilderness is Mount Katahdin. And so Mount Katahdin is 5,200 tall, so it's above tree line. And it's a very tough climb, because you're hiking from, like, you're doing, like, a 4,400-foot climb to the top of it. And it's a boulder field at a eventual point. Like, by boulders, I mean, like, taller than a person boulder. You're clambering, pulling your pack with you. I have this, like, almost humorous picture where, like, at any point on trail, they have, like, these rebar, like, steps. And, like, there's one point where it's, like, there's just one rebar step that's, like, at head height. And, you know, at any other point on trail, they would have put, like, 5 steps right there. But, no, you gotta, like, raise your foot all the way up there to get up. And it also puts into perspective, because it's a very famous mountain, so a lot of people like to hike it. But they suggest for a 5-mile hike up, 5-mile hike back, to leave before 9 a.m. That way you can get back before dark. So, and that's like crazy for a 10-mile hike, you know?
Yeah.
And so the whole way I'm passing by people, because, you know, there's a few like day hikers or whatever who are trying to hike it, and like you're just blasting through them. I started hiking it at 9 a.m. and I got to the top at noon exactly, which is kind of crazy. And so the last mile is very beautiful, because like the mountain plateaus at the top. So like you've just done a very tough climb over boulders and stuff, and then all of a sudden it's relatively flat, like a stone. Little like stone pebble path, and on either side of you are these tall, long grasses that grow up on top of the mountain. And so it's almost like a lackadaisical hike for that last mile. You get to the top, and, like, it didn't hit me at the very start, but, like, after sitting there for, like, a few minutes, getting my photo with the famous Mount Katahdin sign that says, like, Springer Mountain, Georgia, 2,190 miles. And, like, you know, you just sit there looking out. And, like, I did it on a great day. Because there's some days where it's in the clouds and, like, you can't see anything. I have a ton of photos from friends. When they finished, they didn't have anything. But, like, when I finished, it was a clear day. So I could outlook for miles. See all the different mountains where I came from, the lake I passed by. And it just, like, brought me tears. Like, even now, I'm, like, I'm getting a little emotional about it. Because, like, it hits you then and there that, like,
you just did it.
You look at the sign saying Springer Mountain, Georgia, and you hiked that. You saw every mile.
Dude.
Just, like,
you went through the ups, the downs, the hard days, the good days, meeting people. You accomplished this goal that you set out to do. You so did it, and you're just like, holy smokes, like, it's over.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the funny thing was, is like, yeah, you're like, oh, it's over. And then you have to hike 5 miles back down that super tough terrain. So it's
of
like...
Of course, why wouldn't they make it easy on you?
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, oh, it's over. And then you start hiking again, and you're like getting emotional. And, like, you know, that first mile is easy, like I said. I just went back down the same way because that's where an access road was, where my parents were going to meet me. And going down those same boulders, you're like, man, I hope I don't trip and fall 20 feet. Because that would be an embarrassing thing. You did the whole 18, you injured yourself at the very end.
Yeah, yeah, don't do that. Jeez.
But, like,
was there a part of you that... Was there a part of you that was sad it was over?
I mean, yeah, there definitely was. There's a part of me to be excited that I was, like, you know, heading home, that, like, I could enjoy normal life again. I definitely felt like afterwards I appreciate, like, the little things in life more. But I also, like, just appreciate hiking a lot more than I used to, if that makes sense.
No,
and
sure.
Like, I don't exactly see it the same way as I did beforehand. Like, I have the context of everything that I did and everything I saw and all the people who helped maintain that trail.
Mm.
And it's like, it just blows my mind.
Man, that's so cool.
Yeah.
It's seriously cool that you did that for a lot of reasons, man. Like, one is so many people quit, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, a third of the people that start finish it, I think is what you said, right? 20-30% actually do it. So that's a huge accomplishment. But then also, like, there are so many people out there who just, like, talk about doing something and just never even, like, start it. Never even
Oh, yeah.
It. They're like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do that one day, and that one day never comes, and they never go do it. And you did it, and you did it at 24 years old, which is, like, really cool, man.
Yeah.
It's really, really, very inspiring, because it's just super inspiring. Man.
Yeah. And, like, I also want to tell people, like, I would say there's a much bigger mental aspect to it than people give it credit, because, like, a lot of the people who quit was not because they physically couldn't do this, or it wasn't even because of physical reasons. It's because mentally they got bogged down. So, like, I try to tell people, like, hey, anyone can do this. I met people who were, like, the oldest person who ever hiked the AT was, like, 84 years old, and he did it. And it's like,
wow.
You know, anyone, as long as you can, like, walk a few miles, you know, you can do this. You just have to keep in mind, like, as you're going through this, it's going to be harder at the start. You don't know as much at the start. Your body's not in as good shape. but eventually your body will get in shape. You're going to learn a lot more about what to carry. And you're going to wake up one day and realize, like, wow, you know, you have, like, an expertise in hiking that a lot of people never get.
100%.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And also, like, to bring up a little bit about, like, you know, Hurricane Helene happened recently. And so, you know, a lot of these towns have been impacted. And so the AT going through those sections have also been damaged. They don't know how much at the moment because, you know, most of the efforts right now are just in disaster recovery and all of that. But, like, towns I went through, like Irwin, Hot Springs, Damascus, all of them got severe flooding and, like, destruction. So, like, I have a photo of me and a couple guys leaving Hot Springs, and then I compared it to some photos I saw of Hot Springs where, like, the outfitter we were at, the floor got, like, ripped, like, up. The building's still there, but, like, the floor ripped apart the front of the building, the glass is all shattered, the door's missing. It's just, like, I have a photo from just a few months ago of where I was there.
Wow.
And so...
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's, like, it's probably going to be a couple of years before, maybe longer before, like, the AT is in the same condition. Now, from most of the people I've been talking to, they're fairly certain that, like, the AT will be hikeable next year. It's just, like, you may have to do some more river crossings and such, because, like, bridges that were there are now destroyed. Like, there is a bridge in Irwin that goes over a river, and now that's torn apart. And that was, like, a road bridge, like, you know, with cars and stuff. So it wasn't some, like, little wooden bridge they can easily replace.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that storm did a lot of damage. It really messed a lot of things up, which is really sad. Which is, yeah.
But, like, well, when I finished, so I mentioned earlier about the ATC and the clubs that maintain the trail. I joined the Georgia ATC. So that's the club that maintains the Georgia section. So I joined them before Hurricane Helene, but now we've been doing some stuff. Fortunately, Georgia was not, the Georgia Trail was not heavily impacted, more like just a rough storm. Pretty much we've cleared the down trees. None of the bridges here have been affected, but, you know, eventually we'll start sending people up north to the North Carolinas, especially to, like, help out with their trail clubs to fix the trail, because they'll need extra help, you know?
Yeah, that's crazy.
I just felt very fortunate I was able to hike the trail when I did, because, like, you never know when something's going to happen. And, like, you know, like, there's so many people I met on trail who said, I always wanted to do that. And, like, you know, I didn't want to be rude to people because, like, Taxi, I mentioned him before, he was 62 years old. He retired from teaching. He was, like, an ultra marathoner when he was, like, younger and stuff. So, and he kept up with that. So he was in bit shape, but, like, he's 62 and he's out there and he did it, like, what was it, like, 10, 15 days longer than I did, which is, like, super impressive. And so I want to tell some of these people, like, hey, just because you're, like, a little bit older than I am doesn't mean you can't still do this. I mean, finding the time to do it is another thing, but, like, you can do it if you put
your mind to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, so many people believe the lie that they can't do something. Mm-hmm. And as long as you're going to say you can't do something, yeah, you're going to be right. You're not going to be able to do it. But you can't. It's a lie. Once you decide to believe that, okay, I can do this, then you just go and you just figure it out. Like you said, like, you start, it's rough, you gotta learn things, you're making mistakes, you're carrying too much weight, you have slow days, and then all of a sudden you find your stride, and then you're like, okay, I can ditch this and not carry it. Okay, now I can set up camp faster. Now I know how to hike these trails a little bit quicker, be more efficient. And the next thing you know, you're like, all right, I got a hang of this. And then you get the norovirus, and you gotta take 4 days off. There's always that, too. Well, dude, let's we're just over now. We'll wrap this thing up because I know you got to get going. I've got a actually got another podcast I'm doing here in a minute.
Oh, that's awesome.
Hopefully, I didn't have the audio too bad on this. I've been checking it as we've been going along. Really, 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 really appreciate you hopping on here and sharing all this with people, man. I think people are going to find a lot of inspiration in this.
Oh, yeah.
Just to go do something that maybe they've been thinking about and have the opportunity to do. They've just been telling themselves the story of like, oh, I can't, or oh, I don't have whatever. It's like, you can do it. You can go and get it done, bro. And I mean, I'm just inspired by you, man. Seriously, like, so inspired that you did this. One day I'm going to do it. And like, when it comes time to it, I'm going to hit you up and be like, yo, is my back correctly? Like, do I have anything?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Well, it was cool, great, man. Talking to you. Thank you so much for having me on here.
Yeah, bro. Where can people find you on social media? Are you more on TikTok or Instagram?
So I have a TikTok and Instagram account. So on Instagram, it's HikeTheHikeAT. And then on TikTok, it's TuttleAT. And so just look me up. And probably the best way to look me up is just search on Instagram or TikTok. Be like, Tuttle, Appalachian Trail Through Hike. And you should be able to find me pretty fast.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Hey, one last question.
Oh, of course.
Did you see, like, where you were going? Did you see any bears or anything?
Oh, yeah. So, I saw 4 different bears. There's a point on the trail where it actually goes through a wildlife sanctuary in New York. And so, they have 2 bears there who are, like, injured or whatever, and they can't, like, be returned to the wild. And then I saw 2 bears while in Massachusetts. But it's the wildest thing. Because I've seen more bear on a 4-day hike before than I did, like, on the whole trail.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, so, like, you know, and black bear, they're smaller, you know, and, like, if you make a lot of noise, they're going to scare off pretty easily. So I think a lot of people put in their head that, like, hiking out east, like, you're going to run into a grizzly bear. But they're not out here. Black bears are a lot shyer. And then I did get to see a moose for the first time in my life in Maine, and that towering creatures. I only saw like a female one, but like even that was just like this like huge, like I think they're larger than horses, like just moving so fast in the woods. It's just crazy.
Dude, that's awesome. Oh my gosh. That's intimidating, dude, because horses are massive.
Oh yeah.
Certain horses. There's a horse here where I'm living, and, I mean, he's a giant. So thinking about a moose in the wilderness that's bigger than that, it's like, yo, I ain't going nowhere near you, dude.
Oh, yeah. And then, like, I saw my fair share of, like, porcupines, birds of all sorts, loons. People love to see, like, loons up north, too. They're, like, they have a very weird mating call. But that I just saw so many awesome things. But the moose was a highlight.
Yeah, you had an amazing experience, bro. Something to take with you forever. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, dude. Well, hey, enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you so much. Thank you for hopping on, man.
We'll have to do it again, bro.
Well, I'm planning, after grad school, I'm planning to do the other 2 major trails in the U.S., the Pacific Crest one and the Continental Divide Trail. So maybe we'll chat after I do that.
Yeah, let's go, dude. You're good. That's amazing. All right, cool. Yeah, you'll definitely have to keep me up to date on what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, you have a great day.
All right. All right, you guys, thank you for listening. If you're watching on YouTube, thank you for watching. This has been another Strain Forward podcast with Mr. Hudson Brock. Go find him on social media. Again, guys, choose to go after whatever it is you want to go after and you're running from. Go after. You can do it, all right? And as always, keep moving forward. Cool.
Mm.